Okay, the middle chapter now of the three in this unit is about more than just cellular respiration, even though that's the title of it. And that might be what the link is called. The links are just the names of the chapters. But cellular respiration is just part of the overall process that this chapter studies. The overall process that we're looking at is the complete oxidation of glucose. And I say glucose in particular, which is a fuel, not because other fuels can't be used. They are. There's other fuels that can be used by cells. But glucose is the master fuel for all organisms. So it's the fuel most often used. All right? Now, the complete oxidation of glucose is a way of accomplishing the maximization of the extraction of energy that's contained in that glucose originally. Remember when we looked at the hydroelectric plants, the water spilling downhill, turning the turbines? I told you that we are an open system, but we're more like the multi-step open system than the single-step open system. There's a lot of energy in glucose, but we don't release it all at once. We release it stepwise. And as we'll be talking much more about, we release the energy from the fuel by oxidizing the fuel. And if you completely oxidize the fuel, that means you've gotten as much usable energy out of it as you can. And so that is the overall process, complete oxidation of glucose. And that's what this should say rather than cellular respiration. Cellular respiration is just part of it. Complete oxidation of glucose. And there are two parts to that. If you're going to completely oxidize the fuel, meaning use it maximally efficiently, then you start with glycolysis, which is part of the complete oxidation of glucose. That's the first part. Glycolysis is itself a 10-step biochemical pathway. But I'm saying those 10 steps make up glycolysis. That's one part of the complete oxidation of glucose. That extracts some of the energy that's in glucose. In other words, glucose partially is oxidized in glycolysis. But what is left over, which is we'll see, is pyruvate, is still valuable fuel. Still has a lot of energy in it, which means you could go further than just getting some of the energy out of the original glucose. And you can now treat that pyruvate, which is the end product of glycolysis, as fuel and get even more energy out of it. That's what the second part of the complete oxidation of glucose is all about. And that second part, which is also multiple steps within it, is cellular respiration. Okay, so the two major parts of the complete oxidation of glucose is glycolysis first and then cellular respiration. And if a cell is able to do that, because not all cells can undergo cellular respiration, but if a cell is able to do that, then the energy that was in the glucose originally is extracted efficiently. Of course, a lot of that energy gets wasted as heat. There's nothing you can do about the second law of thermodynamics. But so much of the energy gets extracted if you go through the whole two steps, that a lot more ATP can be produced using that extracted energy than can be produced if the only thing you do is glycolysis. Because you're using the fuel completely. You're completely oxidizing it. All right, now, the picture that we see here, the green background in the rectangle, represents an ecosystem. Any given ecosystem. Well, almost every ecosystem. A typical ecosystem, though, as we've talked about, has energy coming into it as sunlight. That energy gets transferred and transformed within the ecosystem and then leaves as heat. We've talked about this in the first chapter, right? And so that's true. But what happens to that energy is really the focus of this chapter. And in the ecosystem, you have producers, which are photosynthetic organisms, or I should, it's really the other way around. Photosynthetic organisms are producers. And you have consumers. Now, what makes something a producer is that it's able to produce organic compounds out of inorganic compounds, inorganic sources of carbon. Remember that just having carbon in the molecule does not necessarily make it organic, right? Or in the substance, whether it's a molecule or not. Pure carbon is not organic, and neither is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the inorganic form of carbon that the photosynthetic producers of the world are able to use as a starting material and produce organic compounds out of that. Organic compounds have that carbon that's in carbon dioxide originally, but also there's a bunch of hydrogens, and also there are multiple carbons, right? A single carbon dioxide molecule has just a single carbon in it. An organic compound that's produced by photosynthesis has multiple carbons, so several carbon dioxides contribute carbon to this, plus hydrogens to make them organic compounds. So right away, just that description of producing these more complex more complex organic compounds out of the less complex inorganic compounds should tell you that that's an endergonic process, right? Building up organic molecules that are more complex out of inorganic simple molecules is expensive energetically, endergonic, and anabolic. But beyond just how expensive it is, which is important in itself, only producers are able to do this. We can never do this, we consumers. The process gets its own special name. The process of starting with inorganic carbon as a source of carbon and producing organic compounds is called carbon fixation. That is the very special thing that all producers do and that only producers can do. A consumer, just like any other organism, requires organic compounds because organic compounds make up all the four biological macromolecules. They're all organic macromolecules. So all organisms vitally require organic compounds. Producers can make them, though, out of inorganic things, and consumers can't. So consumers have to take in molecules as nutrients, food, that are already in organic form because they can't make their own organic molecules. They can rearrange organic molecules into other organic molecules, but they have to have carbon come into them already in organic form. That's why we rely on the producers. Now, what this stuff inside the ecosystem on this slide shows you is that there is a reciprocal relationship between the two major processes that we're going to study in these next two chapters. Those two major processes our photosynthesis and the complete oxidation of glucose. A reciprocal relationship is one in which one thing undoes the other. They're reverses of each other in a sense. I mean, they're strictly speaking, they're not reverses of each other, but they undo each other. That's the reciprocity or the reciprocal relationship. Let me just show you what I mean by this. Carbon dioxide is not organic. Water and carbon dioxide are the inputs into the set of reactions called photosynthesis. Only producers can do this, like plants, for instance. They fix the carbon. That's the big deal about photosynthesis. It fixes the carbon, which means it takes it from the inorganic carbon dioxide form and makes organic molecules, sugars, out of it. And notice that in the process, oxygen also gets produced as a byproduct. Okay? From the viewpoint of photosynthesis, oxygen is just a waste material. Organic molecules is the goal, in a sense, of photosynthesis. And the plant is not doing that to feed us, of course. The plant is doing that to feed itself. All right. But anyway, that's one half of the reciprocal relationship. You start with carbon dioxide and water. You end up with organic molecules, including glucose and oxygen. The complete oxidation of glucose is exactly the opposite. That's what's happening in our cells. Glycolysis first. That's burning the glucose partially, producing something that I said earlier was pyruvate. That's not burning it all the way. That's using some of the energy. And then the mitochondria in the cells of the us consumers burn the rest of that fuel, that pyruvate. That's cellular respiration. But together, glycolysis and cellular respiration make up this complete oxidation of glucose. And in the process, not only is energy released, which some of which can be captured to produce ATP molecules, but you are undoing what photosynthesis did. You're starting with that organic fuel, the glucose, and you're dismantling it, completely oxidizing it into the inorganic carbon dioxide molecule. And in the process, produce water as a byproduct. So the two outputs of the complete oxidation of glucose are the two inputs of photosynthesis, and the two outputs of photosynthesis are the two inputs into the complete oxidation of glucose. That's the reciprocal relationship. The only thing that's different here is the energy. Energy comes in and powers photosynthesis in the form of sunlight. Energy comes out of the complete oxidation of glucose in the form of ATP molecules, those house chemical energy. But the chemical energy that the ATP holds was originally energy of sunlight. And the heat that you can't do anything about wasting just comes from the inefficiency of the steps in all these processes. All right. Let's go to 2 and talk more about redox. I told you we would be getting a lot more into redox in Unit 3, and we're there now. What does redox stand for?
Oxidation.
Right. It is just a portmanteau, a shortening of two words into one. Reduction and oxidation. And it's nice that it has been put into one word, because it reminds us of the fact that you can't have one without the other. If there is reduction, there's also oxidation. And do you remember what reduction is specifically? Gain of electron, yes. Whereas oxidation, exactly the opposite, is loss of an electron. Well, here we have the ionization of sodium and chlorine forming two ions, right? Sodium ion and chloride ion, which can then stick together to form sodium chloride. We've talked about this example a lot of times. But this is clearly an example of redox, right? Because ionization involves loss or gain of electrons. So we're talking about redox here. But in any case, the thing that becomes oxidized is the thing that is losing the electron, right? That's why sodium ends up with a positive charge, because losing the electron means there's one fewer negative charge to counteract the positive charges of the protons. And the thing that becomes reduced by receiving the electron is going to become more negative, right, in charge. That's true for ionization. So this is a complete transfer of electrons, and clearly redox. That's a specific case. But slide 3 shows you that we can just generalize this, not with a specific example, but with a general symbol. There is no element X or Y. That's why these are used. They could mean anything. And E minus just refers to, it's just symbol for an electron by itself. So X E minus means whatever X is has this electron originally. Whatever Y is does not have it. But since there's a transfer of electrons, X E minus becomes X. It loses the electron, so that is clearly oxidation, right? The thing that loses the electron gets oxidized, and the thing that receives the electron becomes reduced. Now it is YE minus. Well, what we're really going to be talking about mostly is using fuels to extract energy out of them. And the way we do that is by oxidizing fuels. So when I say that we use our fuels with the ultimate purpose of producing as many ATP as possible to store the energy that was in the fuel in ATP form, which is more versatile, what I really mean specifically chemically is that we are oxidizing the fuels. It's an oxidation of fuels. Fuels get oxidized. Of course, something else has to be reduced. But the way that we get useful energy out of fuels is to oxidize the fuel. All right? We're not at a fuel example yet. But here we are in slide 4. Methane is the fuel here. Now, this is not a fuel that we use, but methane is natural gas. It's not just the simplest hydrocarbon. It is natural gas, like for your stove, for instance. And I've said many times already that hydrocarbons, in general, make excellent fuels. It's for the same reason that they are nonpolar. What makes them nonpolar? Hydrocarbons, not just methane. The smallness of the difference, yes. There is almost no difference in the electronegativity values for carbon and hydrogen, which hydrocarbons are made up of exclusively. So that means all of the bonds between carbon and hydrogen, however many there are in a hydrocarbon, are equal sharing, right? They're covalent bonds, but nonpolar covalent bonds. By equal sharing, that means those electrons aren't particularly close to either one of the two nuclei, represented by the blue dots here. These are the shared electrons. They're not particularly close to the hydrogen or the carbon because of this equal sharing. Well, we've already defined oxidation and reduction in terms of gain or loss of an electron. But actually, it doesn't have to be a complete gain or loss of an electron for it to qualify as reduction and oxidation. It can be partial gain or partial loss of an electron. In other words, electrons, by getting closer to one atom or the other, can qualify as redox. Here, before the burning of this fuel, and burning is combustion. Combustion is a specific chemical reaction in which a fuel reacts with oxygen. So in any given combustion reaction, you have some fuel plus oxygen, and the products are carbon dioxide and water, material products, and that releases energy. So combustion of fuels is exergonic. That's the whole reason we use fuels, to release the energy. But anyway, this unburnt fuel, because the reaction hasn't happened yet, has these shared electrons not close to either of the atoms. When the combustion happens, then oxygen, before the reaction occurs, itself, remember, they're both greedy, but they're equally greedy. So these ones aren't particularly close to either oxygen either. When you let this combustion happen, though, the fuel, and it's always the fuel, as I said, that becomes oxidized, and the oxygen becomes reduced. It's just not a complete transfer of electrons. All right, notice how the blue dots appear on the right half, the after. Carbon dioxide features carbon-oxygen bonds, and oxygen has a much stronger electronegativity than carbon does, which is why these shared electrons are closer now to the oxygen than to the carbon. So oxygen the electrons in oxygen are farther away than they are in carbon dioxide, which means that the oxygen atom in carbon dioxide has been partially reduced. It's a partial gain of electrons compared to where it was here. You see that? Not a complete transfer like an ion, but a partial reduction compared to this. So the oxygen in a combustion reaction gets reduced, and the fuel gets oxidized. Notice these same situation with H and O. Hydrogen has much lower electronegativity, so the oxygen gets reduced. The carbon in the fuel gets oxidized. These electrons are farther away from the carbon now than they were in the fuel. Partial loss of electrons, that's oxidation. Okay, so it doesn't matter what the fuel is, really, as long as it's an organic fuel, I should say. It has to have carbon in it for this to be true. If it's an organic fuel, methane or other things, like carbohydrates, for instance, then if you react them with water in a combustion reaction, you get carbon dioxide and water. The only thing that changes is how much carbon dioxide and water you get. But it's carbon dioxide and water plus energy. Carbon dioxide, though, is, from a fuel perspective, worthless. You should think of carbon dioxide as completely spent fuel. And that's why when I talked about the overall process being the complete oxidation of glucose, this is the fuel, if you completely oxidize it, then the only thing you have left at the end is carbon dioxide. Okay? Glucose is what kind of sugar in terms of how many carbons it has? Glucose is a hexose. So there are six carbons in there, right? Plus oxygens and hydrogens. That's the fuel. The complete oxidation of glucose means getting the most energy out of it, which is going to involve two important things. Completely dismantling the carbon skeleton. So instead of starting with one six-carbon fuel, you have six individual carbon dioxide molecules, just one carbon in each of them. So the skeleton has been completely dismantled. Plus, it involves picking off all of the hydrogens. That's what we do in order to get when we oxidize our fuel, what we're really doing is picking off the hydrogens. Okay? And notice that happened here. You have four hydrogens in methane, the fuel. In the end, you don't have any in what's left over from the fuel, carbon dioxide. All right? The hydrogens end up on water. That's why oxygen gets turned into water, because the hydrogens are now associated with the oxygen rather than the carbon. And if you do that completely, then all you have in the end is carbon dioxide and water. Well, that's what I said involves two major steps, each of which is multiple steps within it. Glycolysis first, which turns the glucose into pyruvate, and then cellular respiration, which continues the process using pyruvate as the starting point and turning it eventually into nothing but carbon dioxide. If you do all of that, then the amount of usable energy is maximized, and therefore the number of ATP molecules that you can make from the energy of one glucose is maximized. If you stopped at glycolysis, you wouldn't get nearly as many ATPs, and you'd have only partially spent fuel. All right, so that's a redox perspective. Let's look at slide 5, which is a summary reaction. Now, this is a summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. So this overall step that we're studying in the whole chapter is summarized by this one reaction. I'm stressing the word summary because in cells, we don't just explosively burn our glucose and release it in one step. You could do that. You could put flame to glucose. And I don't know whether you ever tried burning a marshmallow, but they go up pretty easily. That's a release of all of that energy in one step. And it produces carbon dioxide and water, but that's not manageable to the cell. So this is not what happens in what we're studying. It's just it doesn't tell you the details, the steps that are taken. It just shows you the beginning point and ending point and acts like it's being done in one step. But remember when we looked at the multi-step hydroelectric plant, I told you, I think, that compared to the one step where you have a difference in water levels, you have multiple steps. Well, the overall difference between the initial level of water and the final level of water, which is a G value, is the same as the overall difference when you do it in one step. Similarly, if you do actually burn glucose in one step, combustion, then that change in energy, which would be the delta G, is exactly the same as if you do this in multiple steps, which is what we do. So the delta G is not affected by the path, how many steps you take to get there. It only depends on the beginning and the ending G's. And we just do this in multiple steps so that a little bit at a time, some energy gets released, making ATP along the way. And heat is wasted, but heat doesn't build up so much that it kills us. Okay, but anyway, this is the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. Glucose is C6H12O6. Okay, it's a hexose. It has 6 carbons. The valuable part is that it has all these hydrogens, hydrogen-carbon bonds. Also required is oxygen, if you want to completely oxidize it, and 6 of them specifically. And eventually, after glycolysis and cellular respiration, if they both happen, you'll be left with 6 carbon dioxide. So that's what I meant by dismantling the skeleton. You start with 1 6 carbon fuel. You end up with 6 1 carbon non-fuels, spent fuel molecules, that are now inorganic, right? We're undoing what photosynthesis accomplished. We're turning the organic into inorganic. And you also produce 6 waters in the process because those oxygens receive hydrogens from the fuel to make CH2O. Plus, you liberate a lot of energy. That's the whole point of doing it. Waste heat plus usable energy that gets used to phosphorylate ADP molecules into ATP molecules. That's what stores the energy then. So that's a summary reaction, and we'll start with 6 next time.